past few years is the phrase voter disenfranchisement. We can all think of the election where that phrase really came into vogue. Voter disenfranchisement, meaning ballots where punch card machines didn't quite work correctly, or ballots that were confusing in nature and hard to understand, so that people were not able to vote the way that they believed they were voting. But in these instances where we've heard about voter disenfranchisement, one of the things has been very consistent, and that's that the voter got to the polling place to begin with. All right. I contend that there's another form of voter disenfranchisement that we haven't talked a lot about, and that is the voters who are can't find the polling place to begin with because it keeps shifting, or voters who can't find the polling place open because times of days keep shifting by state law, or that the dates that elections are held keep shifting. And that's what House File 1868 seeks to amend in state law. Three things that House File 1868 has introduced set out to do. Number one was to set uniform election days, and there were 4 days spelled out in 1868 in which any state, county, city, town, or school board election could take place. It also set to unify times of days. We have anywhere in law from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. as the longest time of day when elections can take place, all the way down to 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. when elections can take place. So it sought to unify that. And the third thing it sought to do was to unify polling places so that when somebody went to vote, they were always voting at the same place. All right. And thus, the whole object here is to make voting as simple as possible to maximize turnout of the electorate, something I think we should all be in favor of. So that's 1868 as introduced. This bill was heard in government operations, quite a bit of discussion among some school folk, and some of the issues and concerns that this bill as introduced would bring out. I've had numerous discussions, particularly with Mr. Deans, who is the general counsel for the Minnesota School Boards Association. Those discussions, while we found agreement on a number of places, those places are now presented in the DE1 amendment. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to present it.
All right. All those in favor of DE1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Please proceed, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, what the DE1 amendment does is, from as introduced, is number one, it exempts mail ballots. There was too much involved with mail ballots that it just wouldn't work. Second change in the DE1 amendment is, in the original bill, one of the 4 dates was set for the second Tuesday in June. There was a concern, particularly with graduation times at schools, that would be a difficult time. So the second Tuesday in June was moved to the third Tuesday in May, so a slight shift of that time. The DE1 amendment also removes the common polling place. That was looked at as, while a good goal to attain, would be a big cost, particularly for school elections and those school districts that hold their school elections at the school itself. It was thought that to have to keep open all precinct and all precinct polling places would be a financial burden, and in this time of financial concern, I didn't want to put that unfunded mandate out there, so it removes that. And the third thing that the DE1 amendment does is compromise on the time of day, all right, which is to eliminate in particular the 5 p.m., 8 p.m. time of day, which I believe is just simply too small of a window to be respectful to the electorate. We've compromised to say the smallest time of day that a municipality can use is the 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., or they can use the 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. So that's the bill as amended with the DE1 amendment. Madam Chair, I have with us former representative and now Assistant Deputy Secretary of State, Tony Kielkowski, who would like to say a few things, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Welcome back to your old committee, Representative Tony Kielkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and for the record, Tony Kielkowski, Deputy Secretary of State. I'm going to keep my remarks very brief because I know you have a lot of bills, and I'm sure there's questions and testifiers. The biggest thing that I wanted to express this morning is the following. Most people think that elections happen only very few times during the year. Well, that's not the case. We have plenty of elections. Over the last two-year cycle, we had 71 elections. On different days, different times, different locations across the entire state. One of the things that this bill is trying to do is to bring more uniformity to the election process. I think Representative Viskin's kind of explained things very well. Some you serve in GovOps, and some of the concerns that were raised in GovOps have been addressed in this delete all amendment. I believe this bill goes to local government after here, and so I'm sure there might be some other concerns raised there. We have a lot of people to get ready for any election. In a regular general election, you know, we have all of our counties. They, in turn, have to train and work with the city clerks, 320 of them. And today, it's kind of appropriate that we're hearing this bill today because township elections are taking place today. 1,800 town clerks are out there trying to run elections in all those township meetings taking place throughout our entire country. And then in a regular election, we have to train election judges also, and for any special elections and for all those. And in a regular election, there's somewhere between 28 and 35,000 election judges that need to be trained. What we're trying to do is to bring some more uniformity, to try to make the administration of elections a little bit easier in terms of getting the dates down. But the biggest thing is for the electorate, the 2.5 million registered voters, trying to get them very familiar with the times that elections can take place in terms of the date, also the times of day, and trying to how would I say, franchise more people and make it more available for people to come to the polls. And we'll stand for questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biscuits.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, one other thing that I do want to point out is that special elections to fill vacancies in offices are defined in other sections of statute and are not held bound to the provisions of this law, should it become law.
All right. Are there questions? Representative Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biskins, to your last point, maybe you can help me understand this. It looks like on the delete all amendment, page 1, subdivision 3, paragraph B, indicates the time period in which a special election must be conducted under any other law or charter provision shall be extended to conform to the requirements of this subdivision. It sounds like, at least the language here, is forcing the special elections into this framework. Am I understanding that correctly?
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, and I can ask for help from counsel, Ms. Larson, but I believe subdivision 6 is where we have the out for vacancies. Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, if I could have Mr. Dean's counsel for school boards come forward. All right.
Welcome, Mr. Deans.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm counsel to the School Board Association. I believe that the language that Representative Biskins was talking about is actually on page 1, lines 12 to 14. That was the language that was intended to apply at least to the legislative elections. The language that's that Representative Latz pointed out on page 2 in clause B basically repeats a similar provision that's already in law for school district elections. But if you have a statute that says if you get a petition or whatever, you have to hold an election within 30 days, and that 30 days would not be on one of these four election dates, then it would be extended to that election date. And that would be for primarily for cities, school districts, and county types of elections that come up. I believe that the language that's on page one was intended to not apply, or to make that not apply to your legislative special elections.
Madam Chair.
Representative Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, a follow-up on that. First of all, I'm not seeing where the legislative elections or special elections are necessarily exempted from that, since subdivision 2 of that same provision on page 1 says the section applies to all state, county, municipal, school district, and other political subdivision elections, although it says except to fill a vacancy in office. Required by statute to be held sooner. And so it sounds like we've got some conflicting provisions right there. I'm not sure which one would control. The other thing, if it applies only to local elections, aren't we in effect disenfranchising the local electorate for some extended period of time, longer, quite possibly longer than provided in the other special election provisions in statute, especially if you end up with a primary situation where you've got a primary that might occur in May and then the general election in September. It sounds like an awful long time for there not to be an elected official in a particular office.
This is going to local government, am I correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And so would this question be answered in local government, or can you answer this question for us?
Madam Chair, as I have folks here, and we also have Mr. Black from the Secretary of State's office, I believe that page 1, lines 12 through 14 are pretty clear, right? And I'm not seeing the conflict that Representative Watts is seeing.
Mr. Black.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bert Black, business and legal analyst with the Secretary of State's office. And Madam Chair and Representative Latz, that is the intent of lines 12 through 15, that because that this is all one section and those sections are eliminated, or excuse me, those elections are taken out of the scope of this section, subdivision 6 would not be a conflict because they wouldn't even apply. So those elections to fill a vacancy are just not even within the scope of this act. And the reason for that is because, of course, when there's a vacancy, people need to have representation in government as quickly as possible. And as you know, we have a 28-day cycle, approximately 28-day cycle, for special elections in the state with rare exception. I think the exception is when we have a vacancy in the state Senate. I think
when we're not in session.
The situation there.
I believe when we're not in session, there doesn't have to be election
special,
called immediately.
That's correct, Madam Chair. There are some special rules about vacancies that incur during times when the legislature is not in session, and that is a longer period of time, usually timed to coincide with other elections.
Right.
So that that policy is really what we're trying to extend here, which is to have elections on days that are already familiar to the voter. And so that I think that is the issue, but I'd be glad to discuss this further with you if you have other questions.
Are there any further questions? Representative Segrin.
Pass.
Representative Dimmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biskins, Madam Chair. I like the idea of the uniform days. I'm a little concerned about the times. I think there's a lot of smaller school districts out there that typically will have their elections starting maybe at the end of the school day till, say, 8 o'clock. It may be a hardship on them to have to be open from 10 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock in the evening. And I'm just wondering if there's any provision for that or what your thoughts would be on that.
Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, Representative Dimmer, I appreciate that. Believe me, I do. However, if there is any financial hardship, I believe it would be very minuscule, and the payoff to allow, particularly the reason I feel pretty strongly about the 10 a.m. to 7 as the minimum, is it does give the greatest flexibility to allow people who work in different shifts the opportunity to vote, and to me that is the bigger priority than whatever small cost it may be to a school district to extend their hours 2 or 3 more hours.
I see no other questions. In that case, Representative Biskin renews his motion to pass House File 1868 as amended and move it to the Local Government Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Bill passes. Thank you, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Representative Sikora, does House File 2242, where does it go from here?
House File 2242 would go to environmental policy.
Okay.
And I would like to move this bill, be recommended to pass, and go to environmental policy. This is actually a resolution, not a bill, but it follows the same process.
Excuse me. Representative Sikora moves House File 2242 be recommended to pass and be referred to environment policy. Representative Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those of you who were here the day that we had a presentation by Department of Natural Resources on the permanent school trust lands, how they've been handled, et cetera, have already seen this and understand what it's about. And for those of you who were not here that day, you're probably aware that there are school trust lands that were given to the state originally to help pay for schools. Back in when the Boundary Water Canoe Area was set up, about 87,000 acres estimated of school trust lands were put into the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. And there was no compensation ever given to the Permanent School Trust Fund for those acres of land. What this resolution does is, first of all, it adds a $3 fee to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Reservation fee that would then be sent to our Permanent School Trust Lands Fund. Now, this resolution has to go to Congress because that is a national issue. And then we also ask, in addition to that, which I think is going to raise maybe $60,000 to $90,000 a year is all, that the federal government be requested to work with our state and our delegation to fulfill its obligation with respect to the school trust lands and find some way to compensate us for some of those lands, whether it be by a trade of other lands, whether it be by payment for acres of land or some combination thereof, whatever. But we would like to see some permanent resolution take place on that. So that is what this bill is about. And we have Sarah Stroman here. Sarah, would you introduce yourself to talk about this?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Stroman. I'm the policy director for the Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness. And the Friends is a nonprofit conservation organization. Our mission is to protect, preserve, and restore the wilderness character of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness and Quetico Superior Ecosystem. And I'm pleased to be here to express our organization's support for House File 2242. And I've sent around a couple of handouts, and one of those is just a one-page legislative brief. And you'll see on that there's a number of our colleague organizations that are also supporting this fee proposal included in this resolution that's before you today. And what I wanted to do before I talk about why we think this fee approach is a good approach at this time is to just give a little bit of historical context of these lands in the Boundary Waters, and I'm going to do this briefly. But this committee did hear from DNR with a little bit of background about the trust lands, and I just wanted to provide a little bit of context of the trust lands in the Boundary Waters. And the first thing that I wanted to point out is that the situation is not new. The situation of having these trust lands in the protected status of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. The area that we now know as the BWCAW was designated as the Superior Roadless Area way back in 1926. And that designation essentially gave it its first wilderness-like protection. which was then extended in 1964 as part of the Federal Wilderness Act. The Boundary Waters was included as one of the first units of that federal wilderness system. And then the 1978 Boundary Waters Act gave the area the protections that it enjoys today. And throughout all of this time, when these various protective measures were being enacted, the state's policy was one of a partnership in the wilderness. And for some reason that I can't explain to you, the trust land status of those state lands was not considered. But in 1977, during the congressional hearings on the BWCA, DNR Commissioner William Nye testified, "The past history of state effort to protect the BWCA proves the wisdom of leaving intact this dual jurisdiction." And again, his testimony didn't mention the trust status of those lands. And so the concern over the fiduciary obligations of these lands in the Boundary Waters is relatively recent, and we think that it's a very appropriate concern, and our interest is really to make sure that our discussion stays focused on that fiduciary responsibility and doesn't turn into another debate on the Boundary Waters, and I think that's exactly what we're doing with House File 2242. Secondly, I just wanted to provide a little bit of background on some of the options that have been discussed over the last few years, options on how to deal with the trust lands and the Boundary Waters. And as Representative Sikora mentioned, one option that's been talked about has been a land exchange, and that would be to exchange those state lands, the state trust lands in the Boundary Waters, for other federal lands outside the Boundary Waters. This proposal has a drawback in that it's a lot of land, so it's a pretty sizable land exchange, and there are fairly significant transaction costs to do that. It's also complicated by the fact that an alteration in the land ownership balance between state and federal land could affect some of the federal payments that go to northern counties and schools, and so that's kind of hampered that approach. The second option that's been discussed has been a federal purchase of the state lands. And this actually was attempted or favored in 1997. All 10 members of our congressional delegation signed a letter to the Secretary of Agriculture asking for an initial $10 million appropriation from the Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund to initiate a purchase. But that process was halted because some of our state legislators here wanted to discuss more options. And now the problem with the purchase is that our Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund is not as healthy of a fund as it was during the late 90s, and so to buy out these 87,000 acres would probably have to occur over a number of years because there's no way we'd get that kind of appropriation all at once. And so that brings us to the fee idea, which has a benefit that it can be enacted relatively soon while we discuss a more permanent solution and figure out how we might achieve something for the long term. The second handout that went around is just a chart comparing the revenue that we project from the fee, which is $93,000 annually we project would be generated from the $3 fee increase, and just compares that to what we think would be generated using revenue methods that DNR currently uses today on other trust lands outside the Boundary Waters. And so if you look at that chart, we've looked at forestry, we've looked at leases that the grant or that the DNR pays the trust fund for grant and aid trails that cross trust fund land. We've looked at the lease methods they use at the OHV park in Gilbert, and then again the fee. And you'll see that the fee greatly surpasses the type of revenue that could be generated from these other recreation-type leases, the grant and aid trail leases and the Gilbert OHV Park lease. And it falls a little bit behind that forestry figure, but not too far. And I do want to stress that the forestry figure is probably a little generous, only because we've had to assume that all 87,000 acres are commercially harvestable. We don't have any timber stand data for those 87,000 acres, so we've just gone ahead and made the assumption that they're all commercially harvestable. I'm just finishing up here. The last benefit we see of the fee is just that there's really been a consensus that's formed around this idea, and diverse parties that have been debating the exchange and the purchase over a number of years have really come together and decided that this is a reasonable approach for the short term here. And so I think it will help foster collaboration on a final solution as well.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Kevin Preschwald. I'm the Wilderness and Public Lands Director for the Isaac Walton League of America here in the Midwest Regional Office in St. Paul. I'm pleased to be here, also adding our organization's support to Representative Sikora's resolution. Our Minnesota division, in fact, last year took a formal position recommending just this kind of position that Representative Sikora is proposing with this bill. We are very pleased to be here and add our support. As Ms. Stroman had said, the state has been a longtime partner in the Boundary Waters, but this issue of the school trust lands within the area has never been adequately addressed. We believe that this resolution that Representative Sikora has before you today is a good way to start, and it will begin to bring money into the permanent school fund and begin addressing some of those fiduciary obligations. So we're pleased to add our support and appreciate Representative Sikora's leadership on this issue.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sikora.
You know, if you all remember last year in some of the discussions we had on some bills, there was a proposal that came forward from Representative Dill and Representative Rukavina to sell some of the Boundary Waters land. And what we're trying to do, and Representative Dill and Rukavina are supportive of this approach, is to try and figure out a better way to do that than look at, what they wanted to do is put a few acres on the block and find out what the value would be if it was sold. But selling it raises all kinds of other issues. So what we're trying to do is get Congress to look at this, take it seriously, and come up with some way of compensating Minnesota. And of course, this $90,000 a year is just a small drop of water in the pond in the BWCA. Are there any questions? We'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Sikora. I don't have a question. I have one of my comments, but since you're not in the chairman's seat, I guess I can get away with it. But I just want to...
Wait a minute.
I just want to compliment you on coming forward with this bill with a lot of players on an issue that's been very controversial. To bring them all together in a bill like this, I think, is to be commended. And I'm also glad to see that you're supportive of the not only the permanent trust fund, but also the environment with increased funding for it, with the fee going to, maybe it's the federal government that is increasing the fee, not the state. But nonetheless, I think that it's good recognition that on all points we need to get more resources for the schools, and protecting the environment is a good thing, too. So on all those planes, I'm very pleased, and I compliment you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Sikora renews her motion that House File 2242 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Environment Policy Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, the bill is passed, and will be re-referred to the Environment Policy Committee. Thank you,
members. Hey, Representative Clemson. You may recall, members, we spent quite a lot of time on this bill, and there were a few pieces to be ironed out. And I believe that has occurred. And Representative Clemson, the motion is to move this, I believe, to the general registry, correct?
That's correct.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members.
the language, I think, that you have before you in the delete all amendments, the proposed language hopefully provides, I mean, it's we've spent seven long days to help provide flexibility in the language and that for schools who implement already some sort of policy for allowing students to possess the EpiPens, and also a specification enough for those schools who seek more guidance in how to allow children to carry the EpiPens and have those immediately accessible to them. And the just to summarize that in this legislation, the purpose of this legislation is to deal with anaphylaxis, which is a life-threatening allergic reaction. Can be manifested in hives, throat constriction, respiratory distress, vomiting, etc. Anaphylaxis can be triggered by foods, insect venom, or medication, so bee stings, allergies to peanut butter, things like that. And epinephrine is the drug that is comparable to adrenaline that the body produces and counteracts the symptoms for anaphylaxis. EpiPens are pre-measured auto-injectors that can be used easily and quickly. But the key is that in some schools and districts, EpiPens are required to be locked in a cabinet or stored in the nurse's office, and these locations may be too far from a student and may delay the imperative administration of epinephrine. And studies on the death from anaphylaxis find it's due to the delay of administration of epinephrine or its lack of use. So that's why we've proposed here that if the doctor says the student must have the epinephrine in order to save his or her life in the event of a fatal potentially fatal anaphylactic reaction, then the school and the healthcare official at the school, the parents and the prescribing physician will sign off on a written plan that may be a 504 but does not have to be a 504 plan, and that that plan will provide for the student to have immediate access to the epinephrine or be able to carry the epinephrine. And the plan must designate who is responsible for helping the student to administer that epinephrine injection. There's also a piece in here, again, that will allow the Commissioner of Education, this is May, this is permissive language, will allow them to write a model policy or form so that those districts who might not have as much staff as some of the larger districts can get some guidance on how this might be best carried out. And that's only if they request that form or that model policy from the department.
Representative Clinton, I think
yes.
We need to move the amendment.
Okay. So I'd like to move the author's amendment to 1915.
DE2. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Are there, do you have anybody, you didn't have anybody to testify today, correct?
No.
And the nurses' organizations are now all right with this?
Yes. They had a slight concern with line 21, school staff, including those responsible for student health care. This is line 21 on page 2 of the amendment. However, I've checked with research, and those responsible for student health care are licensed school nurses in settings where the licensed school nurse is. So that's that language covers that.
All right. Was there anybody else who wanted to testify against this bill? Otherwise, I think we're about ready to vote. Fully informed after two full days of testimony, correct? All right. All those in favor? Representative Clinzing.